The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers, and from
Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
You're listening to Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Justine Paradise.
And I'm Jackie Hilbert. Today we're talking about secrets falling from the sky. You're hearing the first recorded meteorite impact. It's 2013 in the Ural Mountain region of Russia. The meteorite is about to smash into the Earth's atmosphere at hypersonic speeds. It burns brighter than the sun and releases a shockwave believed to be 30 times that of the Hiroshima atomic bomb. Fragments of the meteorite scatter over 50 miles, landing in the snow.
18th century physicists and astronomers were well aware that from time immemorial, many people had believed in the fall of stones and fragments of iron from the sky, as well as in rains of blood, milk, wool, flesh, and gore. Fallen irons had been venerated as signs from heaven and placed in shrines or burial mounds.
That was our producer, Justine, reading from an interview with Dr. Ursula Marvin from 2007.
She was a specialist in what's called mineralogy. When you pick up a rock, you probably know that that rock contains different kinds of minerals, but different rocks are composed of different minerals, almost like a fingerprint. So my name is Kelly Beattie, K-E-L-L-Y-B-E-A-T-T-Y. I am an editor at Sky and Telescope magazine in Cambridge, Massachusetts. What a mineralogist does is study
and that
the
in both the
combination
old and the new world
within that rock. Was it created, you know, in a sandbank? Was it created in a volcano? Did it get pressed and squeezed like the Appalachian Mountains do over millions of years? She was really good at sort of dissecting the minerals that make up individual rocks.
Rocks are made up mostly of minerals, which are crystals like quartz or diamonds. Looking through a microscope at super thin slices of a rock lets you see its mineral composition. This is the rock peridot.
Ursula was pleasant and funny, but in a reserved kind of way. She was not the kind of person you would expect to see in front of a karaoke microphone. She was always polite and professional and pleasant.
My name is Layla McNeil, and I am a writer at Smithsonian.com, and I report on women and gender in the history of science. It's super fun.
In 1921, Marvin was born in Bradford, Vermont. Her house had a view of the White Mountains. In 2001, Marvin described the view like this.
Best of all was just after sunset, when a breathtaking alpenglow lit up the mountains in shades of peach and purple.
I think she could create adventure for herself anywhere that she was. On her way home from class, she would just, like, sled down a hill. She kind of delighted in these types of environments where probably most people taken out of, you know, their comfort and bed and hot shower would not like it. And she seemed to really enjoy that.
Marvin's parents encouraged her to go to college, something few women of her time were able to do. She went to Tufts in Boston and planned to major in history.
She took a geology course, and she was pretty much roped in and fell in love with it. She said that after she left that class, she was spellbound.
Marvin decided to change her major.
She went to Professor Nichols, kind of the person responsible for, you know, planting the seed for her love of geology, and said that she wanted to change her major. And he had told her, no, you cannot major in geology. You should be learning how to cook.
Marvin would later say she just knew she had to pursue geology.
I think even the experience with Nichols, where, you know, someone who she admired told her no, and she kept going anyway, I think shows that she was a very determined person.
She didn't stop at becoming a geologist. She took her expertise beyond this world.
The Eagle has landed. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Meteorites are just rock, like any other rock. They just happen to be from space. Marvin's exceptional ability to identify minerals was perfect for researching space rocks. In 1961, she became part of an elite team at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics.
To appreciate fully Harvard's age and historical significance, one should enter the yard by Johnson Gate and pause for just a moment to read at least a part of the inscription. So eloquent of the vision.
Even at one of the world's most prestigious universities, she continued to face sexism. Women had restricted access to the library. They weren't allowed to sit down and read. They had to stand because their presence could be distracting to men.
Launched on May 14, 1960, from Baikonur.
A video of Marvin reminiscing in front of a packed room of scientists is preserved on YouTube. It's the anniversary of Sputnik 1, which crashed in 1962 during the height of the space race.
And ground control fired, hoping for retro rockets to bring it back to Earth. And instead, they shot it farther into space into a long elliptical orbit, and it stayed there for quite a while.
Someone goofed on a calculation, so the capsule overshot its trajectory.
It began, it was being tracked, and it was...
In the video, Marvin's gleefully holding a life-size model of the wreckage.
A piece, 20 centimeters by 8 or so, like this, fell into the white line in the middle of 8th Street, I believe it was. 8th Street in the corner of Park Street in Manitowoc, Wisconsin.
It left a dent in the pavement.
The police drove by, thought they saw a piece of paper, cardboard, something, and paid no mind until they came back a couple of hours later and decided they had a hazard to driving and picked this thing up out of the street and put it in the gutter.
And she was so excited in that video. I remember watching that, and she seemed just as excited about that, you know, years after working on it, as she probably did at the very beginning, you know?
You can tell she's really passionate about her work.
Oh, absolutely.
I have to say that probably for her, I never asked her this question, but I'm guessing that 1969 was likely the most exciting year in her entire professional life.
Okay, the contingency sample is down, and it's...
That's when sample. The first Apollo mission, Apollo 11, landed on the moon.
It's a little difficult to dig through the initial crust.
Very interesting. It's a very soft surface, but here and there where I plug with the contingency sample collector, I run into a very hard surface.
Neil Armstrong is gathering the very first sample of lunar material with what looks like a plastic bag on the end of a stick.
Very cohesive material of the same sort. I'll try to get a rock in here.
If you think about it, the moon, when you look at it through a telescope, has craters all over it. Those craters are large enough, the impacts are powerful enough to launch pieces of the moon off the surface. Its escape velocity is not very high, and they go off into space, and over time, some of them end up falling onto the Earth.
The impact of an asteroid on the moon sends debris flying through space. A meteorite discovered in Antarctica in the early 70s looked different from all the other meteorites that have been found. Marvin's team analyzed it.
Ursula and other people realized that it had a composition that was very much like the moon rocks that were brought back by the Apollo astronauts.
Antarctica is spectacular because the ice moves all the time. The great dome of ice over Antarctica slowly creeps to the shore in all directions, literally. And then wind erosion wears down the ice, and meteorites appear.
Scientists here quickly realized that Antarctica was basically a catch basin.
When they knew what to look for, scientists discovered thousands of meteorites. The conditions in Antarctica protects meteorites from deteriorating. Marvin wasn't one to just sit in the lab while such treasures could be found.
And when she found out about that, she knew she had to go. And she personally sought out the person who was leading that. And she went.
After traveling halfway around the globe to one of the remotest spots on Earth, encasing oneself in goose down against the cold, mounting a snowmobile, and riding through the vastness, the glimpse of a dark object starts the heart pounding. Racing toward it, the excitement grows as one sees it is not a shadow, not a glacial cobble, but a meteorite.
Marvin wasn't just interested in finding out what the meteorites were made of. She was also keen on discovering how old they were, using newly developed techniques to date rocks.
And it turned out that if you use both of these methods on certain meteorites, they will tell you how long ago it was that the meteorite formed.
Pinpointing the age of the oldest meteorite would unlock a secret that had eluded mankind since the dawn of civilization. Or something like that. Considerados de los más grandes del mundo. Al sur del estado, Valle de Allende. The key to the puzzle landed in Mexico in 1969. It's called the Allende meteorite. Beatty explained the science behind why the Allende meteorite is the Holy Grail. Little bits of matter from early parts of the solar system were floating around in space.
Floating around in space, it's little blobs.
They combined with molten material, and once it cooled down, little blobs stood out.
Became the raisins in this raisin bread rock.
Methods used to date rocks revealed just how long ago the raisins formed, which means we finally have an idea of how old our solar system is.
In a sense, they're kind of a Rosetta Stone because they give us a sense of what came first as the solar system collected from the gas and dust around the sun.
Marvin went on three different expeditions to Antarctica. She personally discovered several dozen meteorites while out in the field.
We could go out in the morning and get snowmobiles and ride side by side across the ice looking between ourselves for black rocks. They come up and sit like apples, ready to be picked up.
Dr. Ursula Marvin died earlier this year at 96. She was a highly respected member of the scientific community. In the 70s, she wrote a book. It's still used in classrooms. She wrote 160 research papers, and she helped other women.
And she wasn't the type of woman who would pull the ladder up behind her after she broke new ground. One of the things that she did with her career was that she coordinated a Space for Women conference where it would help young women prepare for careers in science. So it wasn't just about her being visible. It was about her helping prepare other women for the careers that they want.
She's memorialized by a mountain named after her in Antarctica, and an asteroid, which is orbiting between Mars and Jupiter.
I think that the fact that she has something in the Antarctic named after her and something in space named after her is a symbol of the adventurous spirit, that she not only was exploring the terrestrial, she was also exploring the cosmic.
When Kelly Beatty, the science writer, when he came into the studio, I heard he brought a Tupperware container with him.
Yes, he brought a Tupperware container that was really heavy because it was full of meteorites.
Full of meteorites.
He let me hold a slice of the Allende meteorite, the one that's the oldest thing on the planet. It's actually 30 million years older than the Earth.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was amazing. I felt like I was holding something sacred. I was afraid to touch it.
What did it feel like in your hand?
I mean, it just felt like holding a rock, honestly.
A really, really old rock.
Not only did he let me hold one, he actually gave me my very own meteorite.
He gave you your own. Can I see it?
Yeah, it's right there.
Oh, my God. It's a dark, kind of rusty brown. Where did this come from? What's the story of this fragment?
Yeah, that one came from Odessa, Texas. But it's neat because it's got like rust on it where it has iron in it. And it's slightly magnetic.
Ooh. So thank you to Jackie Helbert for the story on Dr. Ursula Marvin and for showing me a little meteorite here in the studio. And coming up next on Word of Mouth, another installment of You're So Vain, our New Hampshire Vanity Plate series.
For as long as I can remember, I just had heard a statistic that New Hampshire had like one of the highest rates of vanity plates in the country. And I just always thought that was a fun little quirk of our state. And it's fun to be part of something that's a little bit unique, you know? My name is Renee Habashi. I live in Dover, New Hampshire. I work in Portsmouth, New Hampshire at Madeline's Daughter Bridal Shop. And I drive a really cute Mini Cooper with a little vanity plate, Boo Coop.
That's Boo Coop. B-O-U-C-O-O-P.
B-O-U-C-O-O-P. My maiden name is Bouchard, and so it's like the first part of my last name and then Coop for Cooper, but it also is kind of a play on, I'm French, and so it's a play on the French word beaucoup. So I have little stickers above the license plate that says merci. So merci beaucoup.
You said you've always had a vanity plate on your car?
Ever since I started paying for my own car registration, yeah, I pretty much have always had some kind of vanity plate.
So what was the first one?
It was Egg. It was named after a John Irving character. I was really into John Irving for a while.
For those who might be a little less familiar with John Irving, Egg is a little boy in his 1981 novel, Hotel New Hampshire.
I had probably four or five different characters from his novels that I looked into, and that was the one that was available at the time. I mean, my best friend and I kind of followed him around the state going to any of his readings and lectures and things like that. So I was just a super, super fan.
But there did come a time when Renee regretted her choice of vanity plate.
I was with some friends and we were driving home. It was Halloween weekend and there was some stuff in the road and we kind of stopped to like move these boxes out of the way so that we could keep driving, and it was actually just like a setup. There were kids in the bushes and they threw eggs at us.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And so of course after that everyone was like, well, you named your car Egg, you kind of deserve it.
I don't know. So. it didn't say egg me.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Later she bought her first brand new car off the lot, a Prius, which she named Green Car, GRNCR, which people were a little confused by because the Prius was actually kind of a green-blue. Eventually, she moved away to Pennsylvania for a few years. Wait, so when you were in Pennsylvania, did you just say you didn't have Green Car?
I did. I didn't have a vanity plate at all in Pennsylvania.
Oh, funny. Why not?
Yeah. Well, when I moved there and started to research how to transfer my registration over, their information was very spotty and it was really confusing to try to figure out, like, where do I go? It was just really, they required like a pile of paperwork and a kidney to like
you know, get a driver's license and your car registered. And so the hassle of just getting a basic registration, like, had me so frustrated that I was like, I'm not even going to bother trying to figure out how to get a vanity plate in this state. And so then a few years later when I moved back, and it's easy to do in New Hampshire, so I just got my old one back.
But besides the fact that vanity plates are pretty easy to get in New Hampshire, why do we have so many? Why are we second in the nation in terms of vanity plates, just behind Virginia? I asked Renee, if you've got something to say, why say it on a vanity plate?
I honestly don't know. I just think that we drive our cars a lot around here. You know, we're, even if you live in one of the cities in New Hampshire, it's still not necessarily going to be a walking city. You're probably still going to own a car. And so since you spend a lot of time in it, why not make it something personal and memorable? I do love when I'm driving around town and I see a vanity plate and it's kind of a puzzle to figure out what it is. I think that's fun.
Merci beaucoup, Renee Habashi. If you have a story behind your vanity plate, we would love to hear it. To tell us, visit wordofmouthradio.org, fill out the submission form there, or send us an email at wordofmouth@nhpr.org, and we may be in touch for an upcoming show. That is it for Word of Mouth this week. A special thank you to the Annenberg Foundation
and the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Museum.
This show was produced by Jackie Hilbert with me, Justine Paradise, Taylor Quimby, and Hannah McCarthy.
Erica Janik is our executive producer, and Maureen McMurray is director of Pyramid Schemes and Sad Clown Memes.
Music in this episode from John Michael Foreman,
The Free Harmonic Orchestra,
Welcome Wizard,
Parvis Decree,
Our Sonor Blown Engines,
In the Fallout Shelter,
Blue Dot Sessions,
and Nocturne.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.